I always like to draw the analogy of, you know, some of your listeners will remember 15 years ago, we used to drive without Google Maps or Waze, and you'd actually have to have a sense of direction. And now we couldn't imagine getting around without our digital maps that are updated in real time from the power of the crowd. You know, they are crowdsourcing our speed and location. Pretty private data, if you think about it, depending where you're going at 2 in the morning. But imagine we're all able to opt in and build a Google Maps or Waze for health information that could be shared anonymously, could give us information about our journey, depending on what road, weather, where the cops are hanging out, what our genomes are, patients like me, patients like ours, and create that sort of energy. And we're starting to see some things like that bubble up.
Hello and welcome to HimsCast. I'm your host, Jonah Comstock. I'm joined today by Dr. Daniel Kraft, digital health futurist, man about town, chairman of Singularity University, founder of Digital.Health, involved in the Pandemic X Prize. You have your hand in several startups. And first of all, welcome to the show.
Great to be in the show. Good. It was good to run into you in person in Boston recently.
Yeah. I have brought Dr. Kraft on to talk about the future of telehealth. This is the final associated podcast in our Workplace Reentry series sponsored by Zoom. And we have been talking a lot about where telehealth has been before this pandemic, where it is now. And today I'm really excited to look ahead to where it's going. That may be bigger than what we think of as telehealth now. So we're gonna try to open our minds a little bit and gaze into the crystal ball. But before we jump in, I'd like to thank our sponsor, Zoom. Zoom for healthcare, unified communications that keep you connected and compliant. But first of all, yes, we did run into each other the other day at Health, a couple weeks ago at Health. I was going up an escalator and you were going down it, so we didn't get to have too much of a conversation. But what did you think of the show? Did you hear anything interesting that stuck with you?
Well, I always enjoy those sorts of things, the sort of wandering the big exposition hall and sort of seeing not just what's new, but what's evolved. And, you know, it's impressive to me to see how many things have been manifesting and have been, you know, catalyzed by the pandemic. You sort of introduced me I'm a bit of an accidental futurist, if at all. I think I'm more of a nowist, and whether it's telemedicine or virtual care or internet of medical, whatever you want to call it, I think, you know, what's exciting about today in 2021 as the silver lining of the pandemic is it's been a forcing function to help bring sort of incremental steps, more exponential ones, to bring us virtualized care, data-driven care, remote patient monitoring. And what was sort of evident there at the meeting was a lot of folks in the space growing their platforms, as well as lots of components that are going to build the building blocks to really expand what we can do across the healthcare continuum and more broadly, you know, bring us better care anywhere, anytime, arguably with better costs and better outcomes, and really start to democratize healthcare, not just in the U.S., but around the planet.
So where are we now with virtual care and telehealth? So we can kind of set our level before we go into where we're going.
Well, it was interesting. We were in Boston. I did my residency there quite a while ago at Mass General Hospital in internal medicine and pediatrics. And, you know, telemedicine then was, you know, pick up the phone and try and find the chart that you get from medical records and try and read someone's handwriting or occasionally type or transcribe notes. But telemedicine isn't new.
I think there were carts involved.
Oh, we used to push carts around. The only difference when I visit the White Nine Bigelow Ward at Mass General, the only difference is they don't push around a cart with charts. It's a cart with a computer, which in some ways is good, in some ways is terrible. You know, we're now gluttons to entering data, and it's an electronic record, not an electronic true health system. So I always like to call them epic fail. Sorry about that. You know, one of the opportunities I think still in telehealth is to bring, you know, the traditional telemedicine before the pandemic, even now, is more often around an urgent care or a particular, you know, issue, of which there's some siloed telehealth players. But it's very rare that when you're talking to a provider, a clinician, nurse, whomever, that they're going to have your medical record and know anything about you, let alone your digital health exhaust or your genomics. And I think what's going to emerge, and it's starting to happen with some of the blendings of larger telemedicine players and actual physical and virtual clinics, is that when you talk to a clinician, it may be your actual clinician or specialist. They may have pulled up your Epic or Cerner or Allscripts record. They may have your Apple Watch data and can track your resting heart rate changes, or from your Oura Ring, what your temperature's been if you're claiming you have a fever. So it's going to be hopefully much more integrated. And even before you get up-leveled to the virtual Zoom or other call, you'll have gone through a triage system through chatbots that are going to get smarter and smarter, going to learn you. You come on the system, whether if you're Amazon Alexa or Google Home, and say, I've got abdominal pain, it's going to ask very different questions if you're pregnant, or if you've had your appendix out, or if you have a history of ulcerative colitis. And those will be the first gatekeepers, per se, before you press a button and instantly talk to a doc in a box. And more and more clinicians, a huge percentage now, myself included, have experienced being a patient, but also providing care virtually, and have a lot of thoughts about how to improve that experience on both sides of the equation.
Let's talk about patient data for a minute. You mentioned, you know, there's your consumer generated health data. It's coming off of your Apple Watch, your Fitbit. Maybe it's coming out of your pacemaker or your CGM. We've got your data that lives in the health record. You may have data that lives in several different health records if you have different specialists that are part of different networks. We don't have any kind of a universal patient identifier in this country. There's no single kind of person that all that data can stick to. We're working hard to make some of these different systems talk to each other, but we're not all there yet. So what is that? Where do you think the road ends for that? What's it going to take to get there?
Well, sometimes it's, you know, the matter of aligning incentives. Often the incentives, as you know, and you've written about it, these are data silos, whether it's your wearable device, your EMR, your medical record, your genome, your socioome, all in different buckets that don't easily talk to each other. Sometimes because the payer or the healthcare system or the pharma company or the app company or the consumer wants to own that data. And essentially, we should all be owning our own health information personally, and have the ability to opt in and crowdsource and share that. So I think some of this could ultimately be driven by the power of the human, the consumer, the patient. I always like to draw the analogy of, you know, some of your listeners will remember 15 years ago, we used to drive without Google Maps or Waze, and you'd actually have to have a sense of direction. And now we couldn't imagine getting around without our digital maps that are updated in real time from the power of the crowd. You know, they are crowdsourcing our speed and location. Pretty private data, if you think about it, depending where you're going at 2 in the morning. But imagine we're all able to opt in and build a Google Maps or Waze for health information that could be shared anonymously, could give us information about our journey, depending on what road, weather, where the cops are hanging out, what our genomes are, patients like me, patients like ours, and create that sort of energy. And we're starting to see some things like that bubble up. I was in Israel a couple years ago, gave a talk, and I mentioned the Waze for healthcare, and I then met one of the founders of Waze, and they've launched a platform called StuffThatWorks.health, which is essentially allowing tens of thousands of patients to donate or share what's worked and what hasn't worked for them. Like my small example, I've got plantar fasciitis. I think it's my only medical condition. And I found a plantar fasciitis community and do splints work or injections or stretchings. And as more and more folks donate their insights and data, you get information back, just like you do on the Google Map or Waze. And so I think some of it's a forcing function of we're going to not want to be in this one-size-fits-all world where everyone gets screened for the disease at age 40 or age 55, and that we can end up learning as opposed to the sort of one-size-fits-all methods, often based on 10-year-old-plus double-blinded placebo-controlled trials with a very restricted, not normal subset of patients. So lots of opportunity there. And of course, we need to get the regulators and the payers to get on board with this, and the data scientists, and a lot of obviously progress with HL7 and FHIR that are connecting those dots. So small touch, but I think some of it can be driven by individuals and patient advocates. Our friend Dave DeBroncart, you know, give me my damn data, but also I think now the ability to have a share button and share your data to build a better platform for global health and information.
There's a few pieces of this, and one of them is broad data, but also what you're describing is also around getting away from a narrow view of health and healthcare that involves, you know, what we think of as a doctor's office into you know, some of just like what we think of as wellness and what you're doing at home, you know, over-the-counter things, exercise, nutrition things. And I know at Health, we also heard a lot about this idea of like omnichannel care. You get some of your prescriptions in the mail. You have some chronic condition management that's done by a specialist who comes into your home. You do some things in the Minute Clinic at CVS. So that, to me, is another piece of like when we ask ourselves where healthcare is going, it's this idea of like you can't limit yourself to healthcare as the doctor's office because there's so many more places right now, and the lines between health and wellness are really starting to blur. At least it feels that way to me.
Yeah. I mean, health is becoming everywhere. We traditionally practice not healthcare, but sick care, very much based on that intermittent data that's connected, you know, very, very sporadically at that small fraction of time you used to be in the doctor's office for your primary care annual visit, or God forbid, in the emergency room or ICU. That intermittent data led to our continuous platform of sick care, which is based on a reactive model where we tend to wait for the patient to show up with a heart attack, stroke, or late-stage cancer. So healthcare is not happening mostly when you're in the clinic, but everywhere, anytime. And now we have a lot of ways to touch on that. Again, it could be when you walk into the Minute Clinic, it could be the lab, it could be the virtual platform. 10 years ago, I gave a TED Talk, The Future of Medicine. There's an app for that. And at the time, there were only 35,000 apps only. And now we're at 350,000 plus, some of which are now FDA-cleared apps that are digital therapeutics. Hard to make sense of that milieu, and no one wants to have 50 health apps. So there is this opportunity to build, you know, more integrated health concierges that pull everything from your labs and your social data and your exercise data and your sleep data. And not data. No one wants data. A few years ago at my experimental medicine conference, this cartoonist was listening to a session, and the cartoon is the doctor looking at the patient. So I see your problem. You're generating too much data. And we don't want the data. We want the actionable insights. And the translation to the bedside or the website to make those actionable. And traditionally, you know, I'm a traditional physician scientist. I've talked 17 years from something sort of being discovered and published, like the fact that you can treat ulcers with antibiotics and not surgery, to become standard of care. And that gap needs to narrow. COVID's been a bit of a forcing function for that. But the big picture, yes, care is going to happen anywhere. Through your smart speakers, through your consumer or FDA-cleared wearables, through your smart homes. And we can touch that now, you know, as we've seen with the Apples and the Googles and the Samsungs and the Facebooks and the Microsofts, you know, with all our day-to-day interactions. Even the camera we're talking to through on Zoom can be picking up my heart rate, respiratory rate, micro-expressions, might notice I've got some yellowing in my eyes or a droop or the change in my voice. Voice is a biomarker. So I think we're going to end up in a future with much more continuous data that's much more personalized, can be made more proactive, and again, can start to bring care anywhere, anytime.
Yeah, there's a double-edged sword here, right, because of our relationship with data and data sharing, right? It's amazing that I've always been fascinated by the idea that there's so many biomarkers, you know, that, and I think it was when the Kinect camera came out, they were like, this thing can read your heart rate just passively by looking at you. You know, the voice is a biomarker. I know some people are doing fascinating work with that. But suddenly everything that you're putting into the world is very sensitive data. And we have this weird relationship where we, you know, we're not entirely comfortable sharing our data. Consumers aren't always aware of what they're sharing and how it's being used. We don't have laws to make sure that they are aware of that. We have some laws that they're not necessarily sufficient. So how do we get from there to here in terms of sort of having the healthy relationship that allows us to really unlock the potential of our data?
Yeah, I mean, it is a double-edged sword, and also it's not a zero-sum game. I mean, I'm not a privacy or data expert by any means. I always like to rail, however, against, you know, well-meaning regulations like HIPAA, which are supposed to be for healthcare portability and privacy, but they so much hinder the portability that I've seen examples as a clinician. You know, patient's an extremist in the ER, and you are waiting to get their signature on a faxed form to get their prior EKG sent over from another hospital. And, you know, the patient would probably rather be alive than dead with their privacy intact. And many for the, you know, the next generation, the 20-somethings, you know, they feel very differently about privacy and data. They're very sharing. Or folks in Asia are very different than the GDPR environment in Europe. And maybe, you know, well-meaning regulations like HIPAA need to be rebooted a bit in our digital age. They were written sort of pre-digital. So I think we need to, again, enable everyone to own their health data, have smarter platforms, whether they're blockchain enabled or federated or others, that they can opt in to share mostly de-anonymized when they want to be. But then again, that they feel like they get some information back to that Google Maps or Waze model. And that healthcare systems and others are incentivized to share it, so all ships rise. We could be learning. We're missing lots of learnings because of information that's not shared. So I'm more of a proponent of being a little more, not risky, but letting data be a little more free, leveraging some of our new tools to keep it optionalized and safer and moderated. There's synthetic data and other forms that are being used for virtual clinical trials, the idea of digital twins. Now we have so many layers of data. Again, no one wants the data. We want the actionable insights that are applied to you or to my patient or to my community to be much more proactive and again, hopefully to unlock and unleash its potential with the power of AI, machine learning, et cetera, on top of it, which can give incredible insights earlier at stage zero rather than stage three or stage four.
I think a great example is some of what Apple's been working on now. They're passively monitoring for AFib and irregular rhythms in the Apple Watch. They can passively monitor gait now. You walk around with your phone in your pocket and it notices if your gait is deteriorating. Alexa or Amazon could theoretically be, listening to your voice, not the words that you say, but the way that you say them, and detect everything from depression to the beginnings of Parkinson's disease. I mean, it is really staggering, this idea that, care anywhere could really mean that your devices that are already always listening to you and always watching you could be listening and watching for early signs of all kinds of deterioration and then saying, hey, get this checked out. It's like a little scary, but also a little like exciting to have that potential digital safety net.
Yeah, it's all the way from Black Mirror, when we can be over-quantified and judged and always trying to gamify our score and steps and social interactions. But, what does a good clinician do? They listen to stories and they try and put together these siftings of data. But again, it's very intermittent and based on memory. Now we have this continuous data set. I'm wearing, one of these Aura rings, which many of you have probably seen. I mean, think about all the exponential technology packed into the wrist. And it's mostly used as a good sort of sleep lab on your finger. But the next gen version will have, continuous heart rate and O2 sat, which my Apple Watch already does, or my Fitbit or my Whoop. I like to compare and see what my sleep scores might be from different devices. But what I find interesting is, looking at changes in my baseline. So early in the pandemic, when the gyms were closed and everyone was sort of locked down, I ended up with my, Oculus Quest, in the metaverse, working out in this platform called Supernatural, which was just acquired by Meta. Pretty amazing workout platform. But what was interesting, I did 100 days straight. My resting heart rate went down by like 9 points, and my sleep was better. And I could see that from my digital data that I would never have been able to collect otherwise. And then from the clinician side, whether it's your voice or changes to your resting heart rate, or blood pressure and blood sugar, which I think will be in smartwatches in a couple of years, will be incredible tools to proactively pick up problems early and help also nudge you. Not the obnoxious way that Apple Watches tell you it's time to stand up when you're on a flight or driving, in a much more personalized, proactive bubble around you that really matches your personality and your health goals or your health conditions.
So we both have and haven't strayed away from telehealth, but I want to talk about video visits and what those, or not video visits, but what the virtual visit, could look like going forward. I know there's a lot of talk about synchronous and asynchronous. If you look way ahead, there's ideas about what we could potentially do with VR. What are your thoughts about that? I mean, what's working well now and where could it go?
Well, first of all, particularly if you know your clinician, a traditional patient-doctor relationship, that can be therapeutic, particularly if you've had real-life interactions. And just like in, do we go back to work and how many days in a week do you be physical versus virtual? There's a power to being physical, but also having those digital connections, which can be just as powerful, particularly if you've had the real-life equivalents. And so I think, there's a power to that human touch and human presence. And often patients will do things for their doctors, let's say, and that can be amplified by our virtual visits, which can be done much more readily at lower cost. There can be the idea of digital empathy. I might, if I'm your doctor, I could be sending you, text messages and SMSs and WhatsApps or whatever platform you're on that can encourage you to remember to take your meds or do your workout or do your mindfulness or do your checkup. And all those can be blended with a physical and virtual visit. So I would imagine in a few years, if you're my patient and we already have a relationship and you pop on the screen as a follow-up to something, I will actually, maybe from your connected smart bottle, know that you took your meds or not, or how your walking has been doing, if you had an orthopedic issue, or the fact that your resting heart rate's changed because you have been doing that VR or Peloton or outside real world exercise. And that I will also be guided because, you know, 50% of doctors are below average. And many of us don't remember the genetics we learned 20 years ago, let alone 2 months ago. We'll hopefully get some guidance. It might be to remember to ask you a question based on NLP and that I've gone through some review systems and missed something that you had in your chief complaint. It may be pulling up your pharmacogenetics because I'm about to prescribe you a statin and you might need a atorvastatin at 10 milligrams, not 40, or simvastatin based on your genetics and risk for myopathy. There's a ton of opportunity to have these overlays that you even couldn't do when you're stuck, you know, in a clinic, you know, most of the time typing on the EMR and looking at the patient barely. So there's that face-to-face element that can be enabled, and the NLP on top will write the note for you that you might verify. I'll again have looked at potentially your digital stream from your smartwatch, your smart home. I might have some insights. I like to call it a bit of like a FICO score for your health, because all these data feeds are, you know, interesting, but it's only when you synthesize them. Back to the car example, you know, and even the Apple Watch elements you talked about for AFib, the check engine light for the body, right? I might be getting that early ping saying, you know, hey, Jonah, I've noticed, wow, you your gait's a bit off, you've had a cough, you've lost 5 pounds, your blood pressure's 10 points up. I need to proactively reach out and talk to you and have an element, before you end up showing up in the urgent care. So I think these data layers synthesized are going to be part of our virtual screen. And again, some of that guidance, some of that AI, not just the Google Maps for the patient, but to guide me through that call so that we can up-level every clinician, whether it's a fully trained cardiologist to a nurse practitioner to a mental health worker, to up-level them to really meet the needs of that patient. And again, basing that on hopefully crowdsourced information that isn't 10 years old, but has been updated in real time.
So early in the conversation, you describe yourself as a nowist rather than a futurist. And it is, I think, true that a lot of the technology we're talking about here is not in the far future. It exists today, or the building blocks of it exist, and someone just has to put them together in a way that is, you know, is a reasonable workflow and produces engagement, which is no small task, but what do you think are kind of the barriers between, you know, this really becoming some of the things we've been talking about really becoming a standard of care? I think we've talked about some of them already. But
yeah. Well, one of them, there's that old quote from William Gibson, the future's already here, it's just not evenly distributed. And if you go to HLTH or CES or HIMSS, you see a lot of amazing, sometimes super futuristic feeling technologies. There's, you know, and that's not even the future. There's that Bill Gates quote, we tend to overestimate what happened in a year, underestimate what happened in a decade. I think this next decade will make the last 10 years look slow. But, you know, because things are accelerating, you know, there's available, you know, FDA-cleared wearables, apps, solutions. It's hard for a clinician of today to keep up or know what's even available. So I've been trying to address that problem a bit. I was lucky to get the domain digital.health. It's easy to remember. And I've decided to build that into a bit of a digital health database and formulary. So if you're looking for solutions for diabetes or mental health or renal failure or AI meets GI care, it could be an app or a wearable to track AFib, all the way to a system for doing NLP and helping write your clinical notes, all the way to public health measures. But there's so much out there. We need a bit of a way for clinicians to find and eventually prescribe and eventually have those things reimbursed and entering into the workflow, because no one wants to prescribe the connected blood pressure cuff for their hypertensive patient and have to log into 5 portals to look at that data and not get paid for it. So it's about, you know, taking the technologies that exist and are coming, aligning the incentives, aligning the workflows, not just to prescribe it, but to get the data back in a bit of a useful dashboard. And so that's what we're doing a bit with digital.health. Check out the new version, which is beta.digital.health right now. We'd love help folks to help think about how we expand that into the future. So that's one element. There's almost an embarrassment of solutions, and we're still early on in our sort of digital connected mobile health age.
I think that's something else that I heard a lot at the conference we were both just at, was this idea of, you know, silos too, right? There are so many point solutions. Not only can you not, you know, find one when you need it, or have confidence that you found the best one when you find one. But you also, you have to connect a bunch of them together in a smooth way, and that can be hard too. And so conversations about how do we get, you know, from lots of really good point solutions to an experience that feels fluid, both for the provider and for the patient.
Well, I think we're seeing a bit of the market forces to, you know, unsiloing things. A lot of folks don't just have diabetes or hypertension. They've got that and a mental health issue and cardiovascular disease, and platforms like Vita Health, started by Stephanie Telenius, are kind of managing polychronic diseases with coaching, where, you know, you don't just impact someone's weight and their diabetes, but also their mental health and their cardiovascular care. Or Omada, which started with pre-diabetes, is branching into mental health and hypertension and others. Livongo, another good example. So I think the user and the clinician don't always want siloed solutions, though they often start in that realm. So I think that's one of the trends I think we're starting to see, is sort of integration. And some of those are coming to telemedicine platforms, you know, 23andMe buying Lemonade. I don't know all the details, but, you know, hopefully. And I met Ann and Linda when they were starting that company. I was proposing back then that your genetic information melds with what the clinician can see. Otherwise, it's entertainment. It's a bit of a so what. But how do I now use the low-hanging fruit of pharmacogenetics that we talked about? So I think, you know, more and more integration is going to be there, because, again, you don't want 50 apps for 50 different elements of your care. There are even several startups I've seen recently. I just launched a early stage focused digital health fund that are kind of building that healthcare concierge that are kind of connect all those dots, from your med refills to tracking your mental health to making sure the home care guide is paid for, to connecting with your friends and family. Because again, silos are sometimes good places to innovate, but not always great places to execute in terms of what people want to use in the real world.
Awesome. As we come to the end, is there anything on the horizon, near or far, that we haven't really touched on yet that that is exciting to you when you think about the future of health and healthcare?
Well, there's so many things. I mean, my training is in, you know, general medicine, pediatrics, hematology, oncology, bone marrow transplant. In the transplant world, now we're getting to CRISPRizing and modifying bone marrow stem cells to cure diseases like sickle cell or thalassemia. And, you know, you might not even need to do that ex vivo. You might just be able to put in the vector and cure some diseases genetically. That's a whole other realm of health innovation. mRNA, which, you know, is fascinating and certainly been exploded on the vaccine side. It has other applications for cancer vaccines. I'm getting more interested in sort of the proactive side, whether it's the Grail type technologies to do blood biopsies and find things early. And I think that's a theme of this digital connected age. It's not just your digital biomarkers, but the fact that we'll have more and more connected home diagnostics. As part of this XPRIZE Pandemic Alliance that I've been sharing, I was contacted by Jeff Huber, former VP at Google, founded Grail, and we, with this open screen project, the COVID screening project, developed an XPRIZE for fast, frequent, cheap, and easy COVID testing, something that didn't exist particularly for the first year of the pandemic. And some of the amazing solutions from 700 teams that entered won't just be good for next generation COVID tests that are under 5 minutes, under $5, and very accurate, but will be good for other infectious and non-infectious diseases. And that blends into telemedicine. One of the things we didn't talk about is our telemedicine visits are going to be blended with a lab on the chip, and maybe even eventually the ability to, you know, print your vaccine at home, or one of my telemedicine project to print personalized poly pills that are based on your data. It might be from your mental health data all the way to your blood levels and weight. So I think a lot of these things are going to synergize, and telemedicine is going to be that interface for so much of it, because we really don't need to have, you know, for 80% of our visits, we don't have to have, you know, hands-on elements. Or augmentation. Robots are coming that can do ultrasound, or you get a butterfly ultrasound and do it yourself at home. So these things are all converging, super converging. And I think that's what's exciting about this future of health and medicine. It's no one element. And what's been fun for me in my sort of career as a future/nowist is to help connect the dots and bring folks from different realms, AI, robotics, 3D printing, nanotech, genomics, video gaming. That's where the magic happens. And that's where I'm starting to see some of the best innovations come from, folks outside of traditional health and biomedicine, to sort of see the pain points and solve for them. But still plenty of pain points and plenty of places to go. And a lot of that is still stuck in the regulatory and privacy and data side of the equation.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, early on, we used to write for News in the early days I think we talked about how one paradigm shift that we could see in this space would be when the virtualization of care moved from sort of the virtualization of diagnostics to the virtualization of treatment. And we're already starting to see that with digital therapeutics. But then what you were just talking about, you know, be potentially synthesizing molecules in your own home. Or, you know what I mean? It's a lot further ahead, but it's kind of exciting to think that that could be, you know, in 20 years when we say virtual care, we could be talking about something completely different or something completely different on top of what we're already talking about that maybe we'll just call, you know, care.
Yep. It's, you know, we don't call digital banking and digital music. We're virtualizing, you know, even VR is a platform for therapy, for treating pain, ADHD, for diagnostics, for medical education. So the metaverse, while I'm not a huge fan of Facebook per se, I think those abilities to interconnect in our virtual elements will go well beyond the screen. We'll pop in the next generation Zoom, we'll be in a virtual environment. And I might even be able to, you know, have a different level of interaction with your avatar when you want to represent yourself in a different way. And our, because health is social, you know, that has a whole other piece. Folks who are locked in or have autism or are very remote can have social connections that are very important to their health, because health is social, and that can be enabled in our next generation telehealth, telemedicine platforms. We already know that that works physically and helps in virtual platforms as well. And it's been amazing to see, you know, the Zoomification of telemedicine over the last year. And it's not just, you know, clinical care, it's, you know, virtual collaborations and all these folks I'm sure you and I've worked with and never met in person, but we've met in the virtual environment that have helped accelerate the now and the future of healthcare.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, Dan. It's been really great to chat about this stuff with you. It's always good to talk to you. And I'm looking forward to seeing this this future develop.
It is coming faster than you think, and it requires, you know, teamwork and collaboration and sometimes breaking the silos and thinking a bit differently. Sometimes it's not the new ideas that hold people back, but they're old ones, and particularly it might be the chairman of the department or the payer or the regulator. So we need to bring all these folks along to enable, you know, the future that in some cases is already here, just not evenly distributed, but also to connect the dots with where AI, robotics, 3D printing, nanotech, genomics, CRISPR is going to be in, you know, 2 years and 5 years is going to be somewhat surprising. I mean, just think about, I've got my iPhone 2 in the other room from 10 years ago, 12 years ago. It was amazing when I got my iPhone 2. Now it still works as my old photos on it. It feels slow and clunky and low resolution. My iPhone 13, which I just got, you know, in 5 years will probably look clunky because we'll have it dissolved into our Apple virtual AR goggles. You know, so I always tell people not to have a failure of imagination and to ride the exponential rails a bit. And when you're solving for problems, to solve not with just the technology of 2021, but what's coming next, particularly at the intersection.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. Thanks again to our sponsor, Zoom. Zoom for Healthcare, unified communications to keep you connected and compliant. This is the last of our series of podcasts sponsored by Zoom, our workplace reentry series. It's also connected to a companion TV series, and each episode has a TV episode and a podcast that go together. So you can check out our companion episode to this, where I talked to Zoom's own Ron Emerson a little bit about what the future looks like from their perspective. Thanks so much for joining us on this whole journey, those of you who have tuned in. And obviously, as always, we'll have some links in the show notes to some of the things that we've mentioned, talked about on the podcast. Until next time, keep innovating, keep being a healthcare changemaker.